Okay, good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And today we have a very special, mysterious event. We're joined by our friend, Allison Montclair, who Barbara will be discussing his real identity. And his brand, I'm sorry, getting ahead of myself here. The brand new book again is called Rogue's Company. And they've done a beautiful job with these covers. And here are the first two books in the series right here. So as you can tell from his name on the screen, I'll let Barbara do the reveal. But as always, I'll be monitoring the Facebook comments. So if you have questions for our special guest today or Barbara, go ahead and put them in the comments field and I'll emerge from the shadows when Barbara summons me to ask some of your questions. So anyway, over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Allison, what a real pleasure to welcome you to the Poison Pen. And I'm trying to think, I think the last time we saw you was in 2008 when you appeared as Alan Gordon, your actual authorial name.
The one time I was at the store, because you're like in a whole other part of the country from New York where I live. But I was very happy to come out there, and I had the great honor to be in a presentation or a two-person panel with the late Sharon K. Penman, who was brilliant and very lovely to me, very gracious. So, but yeah, that was the one time I was at the store.
Well,
and hello, everybody.
Sharon did write a few medieval mysteries set at the time of Henry II and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine. But she, you know, she was a brilliant historical novelist, but brought them together because Alan is the author of the of 13th Night and seven other books about Fest the Fool. It was a wonderful medieval mysteries. This is the second one called Jester Leaps In, which he autographed for me and which I really treasure. And from that, Alan, having read those and now reading your Allison Montclair series, which is three books, as Patrick pointed out, The Right Sort of Man, A Royal Affair, and Rogue's Company, that there are certainly things that carry over from your earlier books into these books. Yeah, one of the most obvious ones is that you obviously really like writing historicals, even though you've leapt from, the 13th century in?
Yeah.
Right.
Beginning of early 13th, yeah.
Yep. To post-World War II London, but immediately post-World War II London. And that's an interesting time, I think, you know, because Britain has survived. We've won the war. Americans are probably still thick on the ground and the whole bit. And people are trying to figure out their lives after the war, which is a subject that is maybe not as often written about as heroism and so forth during the war. So sure. why did you pick 1946 for a Rogue's Company, and what drew you into that?
Well, for all three of the books, a lot of it was the recovery. And you know, and the other thing was dealing with the characters. For those of you who are not familiar with it, I have this is about two women who start up a marriage bureau in 1946 because we didn't have the internet back then, so you had to meet people by being introduced or just randomly. And there was a lot of changeover in the societal structures of how Britain would meet people, because everybody had been thrown together by the war. And you know, people in the army, in the armed services, both men and women would find themselves mingling with people they never would have before the war, because England was very class conscious. And it was class conscious afterwards, but the barriers were breaking down. So I was interested in that changeover. I was interested in having two women. You read a lot about books involving men returning from the war who are returning with their traumas, but you rarely read about the women. And especially when you look at people in England who survived the Blitz, you know, they were not that far from the war as opposed to those of us who were here in the States during that point. We were sending people over, but we were not directly impacted as much. In England, they were just, they were bombarded. They were always under the threat of a potential invasion, and they survived all of that. They lost a huge number of people, but they had, you know, the full effort. And there were women who had their sufferings too. You know, you think of people who've gone over, not just, you know, gone over as spies, there are many of them, but just going over to all over the world in all sorts of support structures. And they were dying too. They were getting, they were giving their lives for their country. You know, I would read stories about transport ships that were sunk. You think about all the troops, and there'd be like 500 female radio operators who were going over to the Pacific. So I became interested in that part of it. And just in two women who are trying to do their part in helping rebuild British society, and in the course of it are recovering themselves as well. Each has had their own trauma. And I'm making it sound very dark. It's not, you know, because there's a lot of humor to it. But that was sort of what interested me in the characters. I had met my editor at St. Martin's, and he is the one who had actually discovered that there was actually a real life marriage bureau run by two women in London, but they started before the war, and he thought that it might be an interesting milieu for me to work with. And I thought, yeah, but I want to work with after the war. And I want to work with recovery. I want to work with societal change. I want to work with the Cold War starting up. I want to work with television happening, because television was already a thing in London. They stopped it right when the war started. They actually had television in like the late 30s. And the last thing they showed before they shut it down, because they didn't want the signals to attract German bombers, was a Walt Disney cartoon. And the first thing they showed when they started up again was that same cartoon, just to show them, yeah, we're going to keep going. So there, all these things happened.
It is a fascinating period. And, you know, it's different than after World War One. The ratio of men to women was so thrown out of balance. There was, as we know, kind of a whole lost generation of women who were never going to find partners because there just weren't enough men to go around. And obviously, right, there were terrible losses in the Second World War, but it wasn't as devastating, I think, in terms, I'm just saying that, I don't know for sure, but I don't feel that there was that terrible shortage of young men that was the case after the First World War. And, you know, you're right, people had been oftentimes dislocated, you know, they'd been evacuated or they'd been sent to places far from wherever their home village or town was, you know, to do jobs and so forth. So, you know, it was very hard for people to meet. I mean, we live in a city where there's an enormous number of incomers, and and it's hard for them to meet. And one of the things I discovered, keeping up the mystery line, is that private investigators have found a job in vetting people, because, you know, when you're all new in a new place, there's none of that family history, the neighbors, the whole bit, you know, where you knew who somebody was, because people could just reinvent themselves and say whatever they wanted. And so that would be, in a way, kind of what the right sort of marriage bureau would be doing in part, wouldn't it be, to not just match people, but also to authenticate people. These people vetting are who they say they are.
Yeah, and that's part of the two of them. One is Iris Sparks, whose wartime experience was in military intelligence. And so she's got, as she puts it, both friends in high and low places. So she's familiar with people who were spies, but she's also familiar with people who were in the underworld who came to work for the war effort. And so she knows forgers, she knows gangsters, and she knows people on the East End who are not the sort of people the aristocrats will be hanging out with. And so she's good at the digging. She's a researcher, she's a scholar, she's been to Cambridge. So she's brings that aspect of herself. And then you have the other person is Gwen Bainbridge, who is from the aristocracy, who married into a wealthy family and whose husband was lost during the war. But she has the social connections and she has that aspect of the world. And they both bring different elements into what they do. They don't go into it thinking, oh, we're going to solve mysteries. They think we're going to find ways of bringing people together and match them up. But then, of course, this being mysteries, you know, things happen. And before they know it, there's
They do happen.
There's a burden.
Sure. And if you're actually part of your job is to authenticate people, then it wouldn't be surprising that you would be led into some tense situations, maybe occasionally murders, because people like to keep secrets. And in fact, in their second book, A Royal Escape, we don't want to say a lot about it, but they gain a royal client, or and it goes to show the reach. You know, one of the things I've always loved about your books is that you do go through a whole social structure, but your detective, whether it was Fest or whether it's these two women, are both insiders and outsiders in society. And,
yes.
You know, and you do, they have special skills. I mean, Fest was a jester, right? So he had a lot of physical skills, and he was very good at deception and so forth. And because of his unusual role, he could go high and low in society. And I think you've done a great job with these two women by kind of dividing those things. So you've got Iris, who has a skill set honed by her service in the war. And you've got Gwen, who has, as you say, this is something Ann Perry has dealt with a lot, you know, in her Victorian mysteries is, you know, Thomas Pitt, a policeman, and he marries somebody in the aristocracy, and she can go and ask questions in the drawing room, and he's down there in the servants' hall, and, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think in a society as stratified as Britain, that makes a lot of sense to do that. But I think the other thing that is the big carryover for me is how funny you are. You know, you are a really witty writer. You're not a slapstick kind of guy or whatever, but you are elegant and witty. And that was true in the Fest books. And I think it's really true in these books. There were lines where I just laughed out loud. And, you know, it's banter between the two women and in conversation, but it's also in their view of, you know, looking at people. So, you know, are you naturally that way, or is this something you bring to writing and, you know, you're not naturally that way? How's that work?
I could give you an answer. My wife could give you another one because I try everything out on her. I was very influenced when I was growing up. Don't want to get, you know, too long about, but, you know, sort of a liberating force for me was when I discovered the Marx Brothers. And again, that's not necessarily subtle humor, but the idea of improvisation has always been a large part of my life. And then later on, I discovered, you know, gestures and commedia dell'arte and things like that. And that's always, you know, something that I would not necessarily be able to pull off myself, but I like to project myself into characters who can. I did a brief foray into open mic stand-up comedy, which was probably bleak and depressing stories to tell, but, you know, occasionally I can make people laugh. But I always used to say I was at the top level of the comedians who are never going to make it, you know. I was about as far as I could get with that. But the writing is, it's a way for me to express it, and it's a lot of fun to do, and I try and keep it organic and natural to the story and to the characters, you know, not force a situation just to get to a joke, or I think I've cut down on the puns with this series. So, you know, I think that's a natural part of me, and I probably, you know, annoy my friends and my colleagues a lot when I try and be funny. So, you know, I should probably tone it down, but my poor wife, you know, she gets the brunt of it. I'm always trying things out on her, but she's my first reader. And she's also, you know, she's had a career as an editor, so she's just a wonderful person she's a wonderful person to have around for any reason, but, you know, for the writing as well. She's just been a huge help and influence on all of this. So it's always fun when I hand her a chapter and then I run off to the other room and then I wait for the laugh or the groan or whatever, you know, to come floating through, and I go, yes, okay.
Well, I think your medieval mysteries, you know, you did lean more heavily on humor, but in this series, it doesn't feel forced at all. I think it's very organic, and for that reason, I think that you can successfully pilot this series through a number of succeeding chapters. Because, I mean, one of the real problems with quote, humorous mystery is that you always have to up the ante. You know, it's the same thing that happens on comedy shows. You know, I mean, Laugh-In was hilarious for a year or two, and then it began to feel strained. And, you know, I remember George Gobel, you know, the first time he sawed off the limb on the tree and the tree fell down and he was still on the limb was hilarious. And then, you know, so you have to kind of keep upping your game. And very often humorous stories or humorous writers, their work turns into caricature because they have to keep upping it in order to make it funny. But that's not what these books are about. These are serious books where these women are doing, you know, real investigations and trying to find their way after the war, which we'll get to. And the humor in it is just part of who they are. But I wouldn't describe these as humorous mysteries. I mean, I didn't think that that is, they're witty, which I think is different.
Yeah, and then actually. And there's also a lot of it is sort of the way they express attitude being women in a male-dominated society, you know, for one thing, and then also frequently finding themselves in unusual situations. I think to a certain extent, humor, when it's used by people in real life, is a defense, which I think comes across. You know, it's part of the face that we show or the shield that we use. So I think I think that's playing a part in how they operate. And then there's just, you know, the relief of, oh my God, can you believe what we just went through, you know, looking back at it. So.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not any different probably than the kind of black humor that people, you know, cops and medical examiners and so forth used to deal with a prison situation. I think looking back on the war, which as you point out, for Londoners was immediate. I mean, it was all around them. That humor would be one way to look at it. But of course, you know, Iris is an outsider too much. And she's the one who I think is more of an iconoclast. I mean, Gwen is trying to find her feet within the family she married into. Right. And now she's a widow and she has a young child and she has his grandparents, her in-laws are hostile. You know, they have a different way of thinking she should bring up this child. They're devastated that their son has died, you know, and they want to take over Gwen's life and raise her child. And because they have the money and the big house and the power, and she doesn't really have any, a lot anyway, it's hard for her to stand up to them. So Iris, on the other hand, has a, well, you tell us about Iris's boyfriend, because I think that was the other thing I very much liked in the Fest the Fool series was the romance, you know, that Fest engaged with other characters and there was always a romance going. And I think you brought that into this series too. So each of them has relationships, but Iris is the one where she's actually got a current lover, whereas Gwen is stuck in a house with her in-laws and her small child trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, well, it's I'm trying to keep different, you know, an imbalance, I guess, going, because that drives things. Iris finds herself at the end of the first book agreeing to date a gangster. In fact, a gang boss. The British term back then was spiv. So you know, a East Ender who's running black markets and probably running a few very unsavory operations. I haven't delved into too deeply, but. A guy named Archie, and it's been a lot of fun to write. And of course, the idea of Iris, you know, it's not just slumming, you know, because that could be a condescending of it, but there's an actual connection they find between them, I think, both being outsiders. Mm-hmm. And it's a relationship. I've become fonder of Archie than I expected as the series has gone on, which I always like, because that when characters surprise me, that means they're developing in ways I didn't expect, and I'm hoping they'll surprise the readers. So I don't know where that relationship's going to go. I finished the fourth book already.
Okay.
And you know, so you know, things I don't want to get into too much, but things are tenuous. You know, it's they've already talked about the fact that they're not the sort of people who can just settle down to a house and a picket fence and raise a family, but what do they do in the meantime? And that's an interesting tension to play with. Iris, you know, is somebody who's never been married, as opposed to Gwen, but she's also probably unquestionably more adventurous in her relationships than Gwen ever has been. and you know, which makes her actually probably unusual for the time, but not not anachronistic either. You know, so it's Gwen, on the other hand, is, you know, suddenly into the real world. She's been sheltered her entire life, and she still doesn't know who she is. You know, she's always been given this role. This role's been forced upon her, and you think, you know, nice velvet cage. You know, it's a world of privilege, but again, she hasn't found out who she is yet, and being exposed to Iris and to this odd world that they keep finding themselves in with gangsters running about is an eye opener. So it's been interesting to see them develop. I'm not trying to say that it's going to be a set pattern. I sort of see what happens each time around, you know. So I don't know in the long run where they're going to end up any more than anybody else does. I'm just waiting to see what happens.
But that's one of the fascinating things about reading it is that, you know, you've got, instead of two teenagers, you know, wondering how they're going to grow up and turn out, you've got two women in, what are they, in their late 20s, something like that, who have survived a number of terrible things. But because of the war, they're having to reinvent themselves. I mean, that was dealt with very interestingly in the TV series Bletchley, where you had the women, you know, a group of women who've been working at Bletchley Park and, you know, had taken the secrecy oath and had been contributing to the war and the whole bit. And then the war is over and they're expected to fall back into pure domestic life. They're not allowed to talk about the work that they did. And they're trying very hard in the TV drama they're working on an investigation because something bad has happened, but they're also trying to find their feet in, you know, having gone from part of a really important war machine back to complete domestic life. Now, Iris, because of the war and so forth, Iris has developed some unusual skills and, you know, some lethal skills. And so she can be more adventurous. And I think it's useful to have somebody like a gangster, just like it's often useful to have a policeman in an amateur sleuth series. You know, you can't, amateur sleuths don't have any power of arrest. So right. At some point, you know, they have to bring the constabulary into play. But I love the idea that, you know, they can also call upon a gangster because there are other kinds of justices that, you know, can be wrought by somebody like him as compared to, you know, the local detective inspector or whatever.
Yeah, if they need to have somebody sort of kept on ice rather than turning him over to the police, Archie's very useful in that respect. But I also didn't want to have him being someone who would then come to the rescue, you know, so I'm trying not to have any damsels in distress and male rescuers here. That would defeat the purpose of the books, I think. You know, I think Gwen and Iris, I mean, they literally rescue each other, but just their friendship in the developing friendship between them and what they learn from each other is also, you know, they're helping themselves recover and learning from each other. And that is, you know, that's, and sometimes they, you know, sometimes there's tensions between them, you know, there's resentments. And any friendship, you have the part that's wonderful and you have the parts that are, him again, you know, kind of her again, whatever, you know. I'm trying to keep it on a very human level. I mean, I think one thing I realized when I started writing the first one that I wasn't really writing mysteries so much as I was writing about a developing friendship between two women in which dead bodies occasionally fell into their paths, you know, despite their, you know, they don't want that. Yeah. You know?
Well, probably be a good idea if you tell us how they met, because, you know, what is the basis of their friendship?
Well, they met at a wedding of a mutual acquaintance. And this is, would have been early 46 or late 45. You know, the war is over and people are starting to get back together again. And they both had a part in the wedding in terms of Gwen was the one who saw that this particular couple might make a match. And Iris had been asked to informally vet the groom by the bride's family and make sure that there were no skeletons or that rumors they heard.
Wow.
So they meet each other at the wedding and they find out that they had each contributed to this, but also that Iris remembered Gwen from her own wedding, from Gwen's wedding, because Iris had been as a date of a distant cousin of Gwen's. And they find that they have this sort of interesting complementary part in this, and they meet for lunch, and before they know it, they're thinking we should do this on a regular basis, you know, between this combination of good matching and good vetting. And that's how they have the idea for starting it up. And it's, of course, the trouble with starting up any new business, especially when you're women in this particular period, is getting anyone to invest in it. And they end up in a very tiny office with two used desks, one of which has a leg missing and is propped up by a copy of the Forsyth Saga, because that was about the thickest book I could think of. And they're slowly, you know, putting together, you know, they have a fee for when you go in the office, and then they have a bounty collected when a marriage actually happens. That's the financial structure of it. And so when the first book starts, they've been going for about 3 months, and they're not really profitable at this point. They're sort of hand to mouth every now and then. You know, the new 5 pounds comes in for a new client, and they put, you know, each take one and then put three in the kitty, and they're trying to live off this. Well, Gwen doesn't need to worry about it because she's already rich, but she doesn't have control over any of her assets. So, and the first book starts when a woman comes in as a prospective customer, and they fix her up with another prospective guy who they think is going to work. And all of a sudden turns out the first woman gets killed, and the guy they set her up with is the main suspect, which is disastrous because it's going to shoot down their, you know, nascent enterprise. And so that's how they're forced into the first investigation, because the police think they got the right guy, and they're thinking, no, we know this guy. We vetted this guy. He's not a murderer. And they have to prove the police wrong. And that's how they get involved.
And then as we pointed, or as I was saying earlier, there is investigative work in doing a matchmaking service. Sure. But you do have to, again, as I've said, authenticate who each person is. So you're right. It's a wonderful basis when one of their clients is accused of something. If they've actually done their homework, they're in a position to make a judgment about whether the client could in fact have done the crime. Your second book, I think, is really ingenious. And I have to say, I wish we could talk about it all the way through, but I don't think that's fair. I should have known it. I really didn't figure out till the very end the thing upon which the solution would occur.
But if I fooled you, I didn't break you up. Wow.
Well, you know, I knew I vaguely knew the deal, but I wish I could talk about it, but I'd forgotten it. And I wondered where you were going with it all the way through. And then of course, subsequently, since Prince Philip is a part of this book, his death reminded me, you know, of how apropos your book is, because I don't think many people actually know the background, his family background all that well. I mean, if you didn't know it, it would have been more obvious what was going to happen. And I think his family had so many difficulties and so forth, that it may not occur to many people why you could write that particular story. But I thought it was fascinating, and it took on, as I say, much greater relevance with his death, in the sense of remembering who he was and where he came from. And, you know, I mean, that's a remarkable life to make it almost to 100, and in a role that he probably temperamentally was never suited to.
Yeah, but it was also, you know, I'm looking at 1946, and I'm just looking at what's happening in society at that point. And one of the things was, again, the courtship, and that was the year they became engaged. You know, they got married in 47 on television. And so, you know, I'm looking at events that I could tie into the books. And sometimes I'm reading through, I read through like the Times of London every day for that period, you know, for the months, you know, which fortunately there was rationing of newsprint. So it wasn't a very long newspaper at that point. It was 8 pages and it shot up to 10 in October or something like that. But I'm just looking for anything that will, you know, trigger an idea. I'm looking at adverts. I'm looking at what inventions are happening. I'm looking at, you know, local events, world events, and you never know what's going to be grist for the mill. So, you know, I thought I definitely had to do something with the engagement, you know, and maybe I'll get to the wedding you know, several books down the line. I think long term. Well, the 48, I get to the London Olympics, you know, so that'll be fun. But I'm not even in 47 yet. You know, I haven't even got to New Year's Eve yet, you know.
So, if you're running a marriage bureau, you know, weddings and engagements are obviously interesting, but it's also true that, you know, that the aristocracy and the royal family were the celebrities. I mean, in America, we're today obsessed, you know, with Hollywood and people who are just famous or being famous. But in England at that time, you know, celebrities were in fact the royal family or people connected with them to some extent. Not all
times had a daily,
but
the Times had a daily court circuit. You know, every day in the Times they would tell you what the royals had done the day before and what they were planning to do today. You know, whether it was opening a new factory or appearing or taking greeting somebody. You know, that was one little column devoted to that daily because everybody had to know.
Exactly, this is all before social media, so you know. It was the Times that was the keeper, as you say, of the court calendar. But now in your third book, A Rogue's Company, you go in a completely different direction. And I thought it was fascinating. In part, you know, you're commenting on Britain's colonial, not yet past. But you bring somebody into London from where? Tell us about it, because I think you did a wonderful job with it.
Oh, thanks. I mean, you know, when you're dealing with the aristocracy, you're dealing with almost the definition of white privilege, because London, England's wealth depended on colonialism as much as anything. And, you know, I'm not trying to beat it too heavily, but, you know, the family that Gwen is in is there because they've exploited resources in Africa, among other places. They're munitions people, they're copper people, they have plantations. So there's an enormous amount of wealth. And in the opening of the book, takes place in what it was then called Lake Nyasa in Nyasaland, which is now Malawi. But it starts off with a steamship accident, which was an actual one I found in the papers. Again, little tiny thing you find in the paper. Oh, how do I use that? And somebody dies amongst the many hundreds of parachutes of significance. We don't know yet why. And then in the very next chapter, we find out that the Bainbridge household is being observed by a man posing as a gardener who is also from Nyasaland. And he will then come to the Right Sort Marriage Bureau, as it's called, and enroll as a client, except something about what he does will start getting Gwen suspicious. And that's sort of where things begin, but we don't know how all this is going to tie together. And eventually it does.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
No, it does. It does really well. But I mean, I like the fact that you moved from, you know, exalted royal circles and, you know, now we're talking with a gentleman from Africa and his concerns, but also Gwen is being forced in this book to have to, negotiate more with her in-laws because her father-in-law, who's been absent, is back and he wants to send her six-year-old son off to public, which we would call private, off to public school. And she doesn't want that to happen. And because her money is tied up, as you say, she has assets, but she doesn't have any control over them. And she lives in their house. How is she going to navigate that? Is she going to assert herself? Her mother-in-law has not been kind to her. Her father-in-law is a bully. And yet, you know, they're really grieving for the loss of their son. And they clearly want their grandson, who's going to be their heir, such as it is. They want him to be okay. But she has different ideas than they do. So you've got a whole wonderful scenario there and a ton of tension built into it. But you said that Gwen doesn't know who she is. So this is a book, it seems to me, where Gwen is having to learn, or is at least starting out to learn who she is.
Yeah, and that's in part because of Iris's influence and help. She knows that Iris, among other things, can handle herself in a fight. She's had martial arts training in the military. And the first time we see Gwen in the book, she's going for her first martial arts lesson, her first self-defense lessons. Not that she's going to immediately become, you know, a full black belt or anything like that, but it's going to allow her to start thinking more in terms of asserting herself. And that's, again, an interesting path for her to take. And it's fun to work with. You know, it allows you, you're talking about, I don't do too much slapstick, but I do a little bit there, I think, you know, because anytime somebody's learning how to do something physical for the first time, there's going to, well, God knows, I would be hilarious to watch if I ever tried to do anything like that. Which is why I'm a writer, not a, you know, a fighter, I guess. So it's part of her development in her own self. You know, she's not thinking of it in terms like, I need to know this so I can then confront my father-in-law, but it does start to allow her some of the mental tools that she needs. And she doesn't know how smart she is. She's a very smart woman. She's uneducated. She hasn't gone to university. She did the sort of normal aristocratic Swiss finishing school. You know, not women were not going into university at the same rates that they are now. In fact, Iris, who is Cambridge educated, Cambridge was still not allowing women to have a degree. Oxford was, but the Cambridge women were given something called the Bachelor of Arts title. And Cambridge was quite clear to saying, that's not a degree. You've done all the same work, but that's not a degree, because that's what the men get, you know? So Gwen's not had that. That's one of the things that she's envious of Iris, having had the education that Gwen hasn't. And Iris is a little envious of Gwen's wealth and, you know, ease of entry into the society. But Gwen's starting to learn some of what Iris knows and vice versa. And that's,
she
again,
is. I mean, I like the fact that she's, you know, learning some defense tactics, or just making her body stronger and her mind stronger. But the other thing is, too, that if the right sort marriage bureau is successful, Gwen will then have access to money that she controls. It's not, you know, the Bainbridge family money, but it will be her own. And that gives her, again, a certain independence and an ability to, I mean, one of the reasons she hasn't been able to do much is she doesn't have any resources. With no income and no home and no skill set, you know, that's employable, she's pretty much stuck, you know, with her son inside the household. But now she's got two different exit lines. She's got an ability to earn income. She's learning to stand up for herself. She's making friends outside the family. But the other thing, and we, again, can't talk about it in any detail, is that unsurprisingly, in a family that's wealthy and old, there are secrets. Ooh.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of what may happen, well, I read the book, so I know what happens, but anyway, part of what can happen in a rogue's company is that Gwen is able to find out a certain amount about the family she's living with that they would prefer not to be public, or that will change their own roles. And so that's an important part of the book too. So I really, you know, I love that whole development. Iris over here, on the other hand, is having to ask herself a lot of questions about, you know, who she is and what she wants to do and whether she really wants to continue her relationship with the gangster and the whole bit. So it's a real growth. I think a royal affair was so focused on the investigation and the people, you know, that was the main part of the book. And in a rogue's company, while there's the mystery and the man from Africa and so forth, I think your focus is more on these two women and their, you know, their a growth spurt, let's say, they are having. What about the fourth book? Can you tell us whether, is all of that coming into play? I mean, you don't want to give it away, but.
It's going to continue. Part of, and I don't want to give too much of, you know, a way about Gwen, but part of what she's going to do is going to involve a certain amount of litigation. And that's the thing that's, you know, against the family and to, you know, gain her own independence. So that's sort of looming. I have a scene where she meets the attorney who's going to take on her case for the first time, and she's trying to talk to him about, you know, what's going on, and then inevitably she starts leading into the investigations, which, like, he's looking at this woman who he thinks is just an aristocrat, and all of a sudden he's hearing about murders, and everything. So it's a fun scene to write. It was a fun scene to write, but it's going to involve, and I'm getting into, again, what was happening. Oh, let me backtrack. I had a moment I was shooting for when I started to write the fourth book, which I was setting up in the second book, which was the premiere of a play, An Inspector Calls by J.B. Priestley, which was in October of 46. And I'd seen the play. I love the play. I mean, I saw a video version. And so, and among other things, it launched the career of a guy named Alec Guinness, who was, you know, a struggling actor at the time, but he had a supporting role in it. And so Alec Guinness shows up in the second book at a reading by a playwright, you know, playing the parts in it. You know, he's just called Alec. He's my friend Alec. He's going to be in the new Priestley play. So I'm trying to set up. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to do something in the theater, you know, because I love theater. That was my intent when I started writing the fourth book. But then I started reading the London Times. And what was happening quite a bit in London or in England at the point was after post-war, one of the things was that there was a tremendous number of Polish refugees from the war, you know, many of whom fought both in an independent Polish army under General Anders, and many who fought with the RAF, something, I think a substantial percentage of the planes that shot down by the RAF, like, you know, 30% of them were shot down by Polish flyers, which is something that you don't hear a lot about. But there were resettlement camps all over England. And there was a major problem saying, well, the war is over. What are we going to do about all these people over here? What are we going to do about Poland? Because Stalin had just carved off about a third of the country, and the Allies were all in negotiations over what the Polish borders were going to be, what's going to happen to the Poles who were living in Germany, what were happening to the Germans who were living in Poland. This was all happening at this point. And in the middle of this, a Polish woman comes to the right sort from one of the resettlement camps looking for help and looking for, you know, to be married off. And they refuse her. And why that happens begins to drive the mystery. So it ended up not involving an inspector calls at all. Except at the end, you know, they have tickets for it and they end up going to see the show, but you know, that's not what the book is about. So it went a completely different direction from where I anticipated when I started doing the research. And I thought, oh, this is all happening. I got to do this. And I was very happy with how it turned out. So that'll be out in June of next year.
I'm glad to hear that. And it's interesting that, you know, that you started out and then the research led you in a different way. There's an author called James R. Benn who's written a wonderful series that takes us all the way through the Second World War with a character called Billy Boyle. But Billy's friend is a Polish count. It's called Kaz. I probably can't even pronounce the Polish name. But that's the only other thing that I have read in which, you know, the role of people from Poland in the war and so forth and in England has been brought out so well. He started his first book with the Norwegian court moving out of Norway into England for the duration of the war. So, you know, we don't know as much about some of the peripheral countries, so to speak, as we do, you know, about the ones that were more in the thick of it, but Norway was dreadfully occupied and Poland was caught in a terrible pincer, you know, between Russia and Germany at the end. And so I like the fact that these stories are bringing things to our attention that, you know, we know less about. But
things I didn't know about either. So that's part of the fun of doing the research. I'll go, oh, this will happen, then I'll buy an entire book about it and, you know, study up and start hitting all the footnotes and finding out where the sources were. So I go down a lot of rabbit
holes. Yeah, you can easily go down rabbit holes, but you're good at not, you know, making them so thick that the book is just a big stumble from one to another. They actually have wonderful logic to them. I asked you, you know, I said that the carryover from one series to the other was that you obviously love writing historicals and you love writing research. Or research, as the British would say. Why is it that England interests, why is it that British history interests you more than American? Why are you choosing to write a British mystery rather than an American mystery in 1946?
I think it was closer to where the action was, both in terms of the recent war. Again, they were recovering. You know, we were not bombed like they were. You know, we were not under threat of imminent invasion, where we were the only, you know, the only, you know, we had an entire oceans, you know, on both sides of our country, you know, between us and the war. So yes, we were hit by, you know, Pearl Harbor, obviously, but that was out in the middle of the Pacific. So there was a divide, and there's whole other things that were happening here you could write about, but I liked the immediacy of it and the aftermath of it. And, you know, that the fact that the damage wasn't just the returning soldiers, it was everybody. It was the whole society. You know, the London was still, you know, the palace was bombed 9 times during the war. You know, the St. Paul's Cathedral, the museums, but, you know, and the neighborhoods. You know, you can live in an ordinary working class neighborhood, but there might be a factory nearby, and that meant the Germans were hitting you if you lived in, you know, Croydon or wherever, where the airfield was, or something like that. So everybody was hit, and those who stayed in London, but then there were people who were shipped out to the country. You know, all of the children were sent out, the evacuees. It just was hugely disruptive compared to what happened here. And that was interesting. And then the post-war, where you have, you know, people being returned, you know, the men coming back to trying to get their old jobs back, but the women, you know, were working in things they'd never done before, and then kind of many times finding out, hey, I like working. I don't want to be a housewife again, or maybe I do want to be a housewife again. There were all of these different tensions happening that were fascinating. So I think that's what drew me to it. And then another part is, you know, any writing for me, you know, just for reading mysteries, it's escapism. I'm getting into another world. You know, I'm leaving. I've been, you know, everybody's living through the pandemic or through whatever. So, you know, I have my day job and I'm looking at my computer screen for 8 hours a day for the day job because I've been working remotely. And then I have the writing and I'm working at the same computer for another couple of hours, you know, a day doing that. You know, the last book I wrote was entirely a pandemic book, which I was in a panic about when I started, because I'm thinking the libraries are closed. How am I going to do this? You know, but you find resources. Apparently the books exist, but you have to buy them yourself, you know, rather than take them out.
There so you are.
That's good for you, though. That's good for you.
Well, I've always enjoyed the fact that your voice is not only witty, but so, it feels so authentic. Obviously, you're not writing, you know, a medieval mystery in Chaucerian English, because then none of us would be able to read it. But it felt appropriate. And certainly, I think in this book, you've done a wonderful job with the British voices, women's voices. And would I hazard a correct guess that your theatrical, you know, training and so forth has allowed you to do that?
I didn't, you know, that overrank my theatrical training. But I inhabit the characters with Iris and Gwen. I mean, I was telling you, I had that lunch with my editor and they started talking on the subway ride home. It was that fast, which was, you know, one of the reasons I know, okay, I should be writing this. So, and I had an idea of their backstories already. You know, I had to work on a lot of the details, but the general of it I had. So a lot of the dialogue, you know, when I say it's organic, I mean, that's just them talking to each other inside my head. And it can happen spontaneously. I mean, that happened with the previous, with the gesture series too, towards the end. I remember one time I was writing a section where Festus said something and his wife snapped him, just went off. And I'm thinking, oh, why did she do that? And I realized that they're having this argument. And I realized, and I thought about it, so, oh yeah, she absolutely would do that. But she just did it on her own inside my head. And that was, okay, this is good. So yeah, I inhabit the characters. I know enough about them that they should react the way they should react and they should talk the way they should talk. In terms of the voices of and the dialogue, there were oral histories that specifically toward, you know, well, both, you know, people living through the Blitz, but also, you know, women who were specifically going through the war. A wonderful book called Debs at War, Deb short for debutantes. And another book compiled of women oral history by a woman named Anne DeCourcy. She wrote a couple of books. The last season, I think, was another, which was about the, you know, the social world of 1939 as the war was approaching. And then there was a group called the Mass Observation Project, which operated in England, specifically in London, who would go around and interview people about specific aspects of society. And they had a whole, you know, they interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people. And so there was a book about living through the Blitz that was from them. Or I was able to get, during the pandemic, access to their archives for a month. You know, I just wrote the university that has them stored. And it says, hi, I'm an American novelist living in New York in his son's old room, trying to write a book. Could I get access to this? And they said, given these circumstances, sure, I'll give you 1 month. And I was frantically reading everything I could there. So that's part of how the research leads to the voices, but a lot of it's just inhabiting them. If I have the character down, they should talk. I remember—
And they talk very convincingly. And I have to say that I was, because you were writing pseudonymously up till this moment, as Alison Gordon, I was running through, you know, the British female authors that I knew, trying to work out which one of them had decided to write this series. And I think obviously your voice is convincing, or I wouldn't have been doing that exercise, would I?
So, good to know. I'm sorry to have been, because like, it's been a strange thing, you know, writing pseudonymously. I'd never done it before, but it's been interesting. You know, it does give you a certain amount of freedom. You don't have to worry about what you sound like. You have to sound like these characters. So it's very much, you know, I mean, every author has their own ego invested in what they're doing, because otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. But it's interesting to sort of let go of that and says, okay, I'm just here at the service of the books. These characters have to exist. It doesn't have to be Alan Gordon doing it. You know, it's not about fame, I want to live forever, whatever, you know, let this happen, you know. So that was liberating. That was an interesting thing to find out. What was the other thing I was going to say about it? I can't even remember at this point.
Well, I can point out to you, there are a number of very well-known authors who chose to adopt pseudonyms for other kinds of work. Ruth Rendell would be an obvious one. Barbara Vine. Barbara Mertz, who was a scholar, wrote one set of books as Elizabeth Peters and a very different kind of book as Barbara Michaels, and a couple of scholarly books under her own name, Barbara Mertz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was in part, I think, I'm sure it was, because the voice and the stories were going to be so different that it confused readers. And it's a question that comes up a lot if somebody starts something new or they come back. In your case, I think your last book was in 2010, so it's been a while.
I had a werewolf book in 2017.
Which, I missed that one. Okay, well,
pretty much everybody did. It's okay. It was a very small press. Right. Again, it started as it came out of a short story that was in an anthology that Tony Kellerner and Charlene Harris put together called Wolvesbane and Mistletoe. And I wrote a short story.
That. Sure. Yeah. No, but I mean, my point is that I've heard many, many writers have talked about, you know, whether they should write some. Michael Carita is another example. Michael Carita, who just has a movie out with Angelina Jolie and all, has done very well for himself, is also adopted a second name called Scott Carson because he wanted to write much more in the field of the supernatural and horror than in the more regular crime and thriller. And it was decided that he would do better to have two different names because the books were so different and the voices were so different. So, you know, it's not at all unusual for authors to do this as a, you know, part of it's a signal and part of it is to find new readers that might not gravitate, but eventually it always comes out. You know, there's Mary and Dick Francis, and everybody was shocked to think that Mary Francis wrote the books, but Dick was the source, he was the authority, you know. And so what difference did it make whether—
Right. Uh-oh, you froze. Okay, can people hear me? Because you just froze. Okay, sorry.
That's all right. I can still hear me, but if— Oh, I'm good. if I'm gone, then Patrick can take over. You're right. We've had a lot of trouble with an unstable internet connection. So tell you what, Alan, let me call Patrick up and he can take over and ask you any questions that fans might have. And Patrick, if I'm gone, I'll just be gone.
No, I'm here.
Just 10 seconds. We're 10 seconds of freezing.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Oh, great. Yeah, Barbara, you just froze very briefly.
Oh, okay.
Came back. It wasn't too bad. But it's funny, some of the questions that the people are asking are ones that you've just been talking about. So why choose a pseudonym for this series is one. And of course, when will book number 4 be out?
Is the June of 20, whatever next year is, 2022.
2022. Do you have a title or can you reveal that?
Well, okay, I have my title. My titles don't always get accepted. So, in fact, of these three books, the first title, The Right Sort of Man, was the only time where the first title was agreed to. So the fourth book is called A Remorsefulness of Exes, which is Iris thinking there's got to be a collective noun for all the ex-boyfriends in her life. So she comes up with, it's like an ascension of larks, A Remorsefulness. Right. I hope they keep the title because I love that title. So, you know, that we'll see, but, it will be out in June. And then after that, we'll see what happens. You know, hopefully the series will keep going.
Let's see.
I'm working on book 5. Sorry.
Gene asks, let's see here. Are you writing another? Yes, you are. What other authors do you like and read?
I'm reading less because it's, the writing is taking over so much of my alarm. Can you hear me? You just wrote there. Okay. There are a few people I absolutely love. Ruth Rendell was mentioned. She's definitely one. P.D. James, I like. American authors, Tony Hillerman is one of my favorites, the Leaphorn and Chi books. I think he's just one of the best we've had. And there's a lot of people who are just writing good stuff all over the place. A good friend of mine back in my medieval days was Gail Fraser, who wrote under Margaret Fraser. And she was one of my favorite people, not just authors. We were like evil twins when we got together. But she also wrote a wonderful medieval series. Actually, she had a spinoff. She had the Dame Frevis and then the Joliffe series. So those were both good. And there's a lot of people. I mean, I, and then a lot of, you know, non-mystery people too. I could just rattle off the book that's blown me away the most in recent years was The Overstory by Richard Powers. Which won the Pulitzer, I think, 2 years ago. Yeah. And that's the sort of book you read. First time I'd read them, and by the end of the book, you're either going to want to become either an eco terrorist or kill yourself. I mean, it's a brilliant, powerful book. Yeah. So what other questions we got?
Let's see. You've actually addressed all of them that I can here. Just a lot, you know, a number of people saying just how much they really enjoy these books. And there is one here. Margaret says, "Hello, Alan. I've been impatiently waiting for you to reveal your pseudonym. Picked up The Right Sort of Man today and we'll read to catch up." So just some nice comments by that, like that. "I love this series. I've been surprised by each book." Lots of nice comments like that.
Nice to hear. Yeah, nice to hear. I don't always hear the comments afterwards. You throw the book out there and you hope for the best, you know?
Well, I certainly think it's a wonderful series. If it's possible, since many of you may not know it, I would start with, there are only 3 books, so it's not that hard. I would start with The Right Sort of Man. And then I would read, I absolutely love A Royal Escape. And I would definitely read, I'm sorry, A Royal Affair. Definitely read that next. And then I would read A Rogue's Company because the characters really are such a major part of this and their development. It's not to say if you stumble on A Rogue's Company, you can't go backwards. But I think if you're new to Alison Moncler, then I would definitely start with The Right Sort of Man and progress forward. I am enchanted with them. I think they're witty. They're very cleverly plotted. The research and the history are terrific. And they provide you an escape, but you also get to learn things. And I agree with Alan that there's much more written about women being heroic during the war, men being heroic during the war, but it's a lot harder to find stories about everybody readjusting. Joseph Cannon wrote a really brilliant book because he's been all over World War II, but he wrote a book called Istanbul Passage, which is a spy story. But nevertheless, that was the same thing. But for a guy, you know, he'd put his life on hold and he joined the early version of the CIA. And, you know, he'd gotten all the way through the war and he'd been great. And now the war ended and he's in Istanbul. And it's like, what? You know, what do I do now? You know, I have no idea where to go with my life. So it isn't just a female question. You know, it was a question for a lot of men as well.
One of the things I see in the Times of London is the want ads, the personal ads, which are on the front page. That's how they did the paper. And there's so many military people looking for professions now, both male and female, and a lot of them want to see the world. You know, they still want the adventure. They've come out, they've been demobilized, they're fluent in whatever languages they have, whatever technical skills they have. They want more adventure, you know, so there's that addiction to it maybe, or whatever, or their lives are just not going to be as interesting in England and they wouldn't need to see more of the world again.
Well, but the English have always said, you know, the whole Sons of Empire thing. I mean, they, you know, one of the reasons the British had an empire was that they had tremendous wanderlust. I mean, they were out exploring and, you know, in their merchant countries. So they were looking for economic opportunities. I mean, the whole idea of the Dutch East India Company, that a private, an early version of a stock, a corporation with shareholders actually took over a subcontinent and ruled it, until the Sepoy Rebellion in 1857 forced the actual British government to step in and take over and make Victoria the Empress. I mean, only the British, you know, would have actually, well, maybe the Dutch did it too, but you know, how rare it is that private enterprise, in fact, became colonists. And that's echoed in this third book here, when Bainbridge comes home. And we see that his wealth is in fact founded in colonial enterprise in Africa. And we talked to Sir Roderick Flood, Patrick and I did on Tuesday, about England's magnificent gardens. And in those slideshows, he pointed to a couple of fabulous British estates and all, but they were built on the profits of slavery. Harwood House, which I call Harwood Hall. And the Princess Royal of Elizabeth's aunt married into that family. I've been to Harwood Hall and been around it. But that whole thing was built on the profits of slavery. So, you know, we're all dealing with our colonial past at the moment. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a brilliant series. So for those of you watching this, I hope you'll spread the word. There'll be a podcast available of our conversation tomorrow. This video will live forever on our Facebook events page, along with other fabulous videos. We obviously have books at the Poison Pen, but you can buy them anywhere. If you have been tempted to read more about Fest of the Fool, some of those books are available still in a digital form, aren't they, Alan?
Yeah, six of the eight are ebooks, so they can still read those. I always tell people to read them in order because I improve as a writer. So if you read them out of order, I get worse. You know?
Well, there is that. There was, back in the 1990s, there was a tremendous amount of medieval mystery fueled by Ellis Peters and by the success of The Name of the Rose, and by the fact that people weren't publishing historical fiction, so people who wrote it leapt into mystery, so they just had to add a murder or two, and they're all over history anyway, so it wasn't even hard. But we had a huge wave of historical mystery in the 90s, and then kind of died away, but I loved it. And I particularly like medieval mystery because there's so much about medieval society and so forth that lends itself, I think, to crime fiction. I mean, it's great. So if you can find these earlier books by Alan, I really recommend them. And I think the new ones are fabulous. So if you're a fan of British mystery and historical fiction, you can't do any better than to read Alison Moncler. So thank you for allowing us to do Alison's first event.
Thank you. I'm very happy that my first event is with you, because you've been so supportive of me over the years. And I just want to thank you for everything you've done and that you continue to do.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Alan. You know, I mean, I'm an easy bribe, because all you have to do is give me a good book and I'm yours. Patrick is the same, you know. I mean, we both, you know, we just live for a really good book, don't we, Patrick?
Absolutely.
So. We have a lot of fun working together to that end. Anyway, thank you all for joining us this evening. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Allison. Thank you, Patrick. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.